Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
The last several weeks, what we have seen in the book of Hosea is God laying out his case against Israel, concentrating on the northern tribes, but then also including the guilt of Judah, the southern tribes. He has talked about how their priests had become corrupt. He has talked about how their prophets are lying. He has said that everybody is guilty, from their kings and their princes all the way down. And so he's been going step by step through the various different divisions of people within Israel. But tonight in chapter 8, he's really going to bear down on the central issue: their hypocrisy in following after other gods. Certainly, he's going to have in mind here the fact that they have tried to make deals with other nations that has come to futility. But he's really going to bear down this week on their adultery, as he calls it, that they are chasing, following gods besides himself. And this has been the history of Israel. You may recall that God made covenant promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But when Abraham asked God, "How can I know that what you've said is true, that I'm going to have a child?" God then told him the future of his people, and it included, "You're going to go into a land where you're not known. You're going to serve those people for 400 years. We know that as the Egyptian captivity. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob had his name changed to Israel. He had 12 sons. The sons ganged up on Joseph, and through a series of providential events, Joseph ended up number two to Pharaoh in Egypt. And that is the way that God moved the children of Israel, the progeny of Israel, into Egypt. And initially, Joseph made sure that they got the best, most fertile land. God also protected them later when the plagues came through Egypt. So they were always God's unique, distinct people. But if you think about it, 400 years, four centuries of time, which meant that there were whole generations of Israelites who were born, who lived, who died in Egypt as slaves, and they wouldn't have known Yahweh. They didn't have access to the scriptures like we have. They would have known the Egyptian pantheon of gods. They would be familiar with Ra, and they would be familiar with the crocodile gods. They would be familiar with the Egyptian gods. And so when Yahweh, the God of Israel, sends Moses to deliver them, that's why Moses asks, "Who should I say sent me when I go to Pharaoh and say, 'Let my people go'?" And then he's going to get a group of people, about a million people, that he is going to deliver out of Egypt, who have a 400-year history of knowing this whole pantheon of gods. Now they're being introduced to Yahweh, not just through the plagues themselves, but in their deliverance, he does these miraculous things for them, like take them through the Red Sea so that they could walk on dry ground, and then drowning all their enemies. These are the kind of demonstrations, the kind of evidence that none of the gods of Egypt were able to produce. He was demonstrating that he was the only God, the powerful God, and the God of Israel. But it's not as if they all just instantly then said, "Well, then you're our God, and we're going to forget all about these other gods that we've lived with for all these years. Instead, they just sort of added Yahweh to the rest of their worship, the rest of their pantheon. So this problem of worshiping other gods is a problem that goes way, way back. On their way out of Egypt, we read in Exodus 32, starting at verse 1, while Moses was up on the mountain receiving the law from God, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said, "Come, make us a god who will go before us." This is just their expectation. This is what they're used to. Okay, he's up there on the mountain. What we need now is an idol. We need something that we can worship. This was standard Egyptian practice. So make us a god who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Now, granted, at the same time, the mountain that Moses is on is covered with dark cloud and thunder and lightning, and there's all these manifestations of the God who brought them out of Egypt. But when you think about the pantheon of Egyptian gods and how you had different gods who performed different tasks, who were over different aspects of what we would call nature, they could see that that God on the mountain was dealing with Moses, but now we don't know what became of him. We'll just turn our attention to a different God. That's what they had been raised with for 400 years. Aaron said to them, "Tear off the golden rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." And then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron. And he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is our God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Okay, now the God who brought them out of Egypt is up on the mountain with Moses. But they crafted a calf, something that was very typical in Egypt. Let's make one of our gods, and then let's accredit to that God the deliverance that Yahweh has actually given us. But we don't know anything about this Yahweh. And he's up there with Moses, and we don't know what's going on up there. So Aaron makes them a calf and announces to them, "This is your God, O Israel. He's the one that brought you up out of the land of Egypt." Again, this is typical of Israel's history and behavior, that they make gods for themselves and then credit those gods with doing the things that Yahweh has actually done, which is why Yahweh can say, "I'm a jealous God." And why he points out several times here that he's the provider, and yet they are crediting other gods, the works of their hands, for doing the things that he has done. Verse 5 says, "Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow shall be a feast to this, your Lord, your new God.' So the next day they rose up early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. Then the Lord said to Moses," Yahweh up there on the mountain talking to Moses, said, "Get down there at once, for your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves." I find it interesting that God decided at that moment that Israel belonged to Moses. It's like, "Not my people. Those are your people. Do something about that. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them, and they have made for themselves a molten calf, and they have worshipped it, and they have sacrificed to it. And they have said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" Notice that God knows in detail what's going on down there at the foot of the mountain, even what people are saying. So Yahweh said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. And of course, that's one of the episodes where Moses actually intervenes between the people and God. But you will notice that he had just delivered them out of the land of Egypt, and he was already that angry with them because they were already that stiff-necked. They were already chasing their other gods. That happened so early on. Well, God was faithful to them, delivered the second generation of them into the land of Canaan, gave each of the tribes their property, divided up the land among the 12 tribes, and then ultimately gave them a king. He ruled them for a while via the judges, but then they wanted a king. And so first he gave them Saul, a ruinous king, but then he gave them David, the man after God's own heart. And David ruled over the collective 12 tribes of Israel. During the time of his son Solomon, Solomon loved many foreign women. And they took his heart away so that he would worship other gods. And as a consequence, God said that he was going to take the kingdom from Solomon, but for David's sake, he wouldn't take all the tribes. He would take 10 of them, and 2 would remain, the tribes of Judah, would remain there under David's continuous rulership, the house of David there. And so during the time of Solomon's son Rehoboam, Jeroboam was set up as the king in the north. And the first thing that he did very early on in his rulership was that he recognized that the people that he was supposed to be king of were required 3 times a year to go to Jerusalem for the feast days. And he knew that if they continued doing that, they would eventually return back to Judah. They would return back to David's continuous line of kings. He knew that he was going to have a hard time genuinely holding on to his kingdom if he allowed that to continue. So his solution was to create, of all things, a calf idol that he set up in Bethel. And you can read about that in 1 Kings 12, 28 to 30. Which says, so the king consulted and made 2 golden calves, and he said to them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel. They are the gods that brought you up from the land of Egypt, which is the same thing that they were told at the foot of Mount Sinai. Time goes by, generations pass, but the same claims are being made. One of the great pieces of history that all the Israelites could agree on was that a powerful God delivered them out of their bondage in Egypt. And so they now were going to give these calves credit for bringing them out of Egypt, these idols that they were going to worship. And of course, it was their king that was telling them to do it. He set one of them in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan, so at the southern area, and then about as far north as you get up in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before one as far as Dan. So by setting up these 2 golden calves in Bethel and Dan, Jeroboam repeated the sins that God had already said were a sin at Mount Sinai. And that essential sin that stirred up the ire and the anger and the wrath of God was making an idol for themselves and then giving the idol credit for the things that Yahweh himself had actually done for them. And they were worshiping and chasing after other gods. Okay, so in chapter 8 of Hosea, we're going to see God single out that one particular God. He's actually going to mention the calf God. And that's why I gave you that little background, that little history, because not only did they set up a calf God at the foot of Mount Sinai, but then their continual worship to keep them from going to Jerusalem and worshiping in the temple where God placed his own name. Instead, King Jeroboam set up two calves, and they were continuing in that worship to the time of Hosea. And so God is going to really zero in on that in chapter 8 to demonstrate again the utter guilt of Israel. Got it? Okay, that was all introduction. And does indeed count against my time tonight because I feel magnanimous. Okay. Chapter 8, verse 1. Put the trumpet to your lips. In other words, sound the alarm. There's an invading army coming. Let everybody know. Like an eagle, the enemy comes against the house of the Lord. That doesn't necessarily mean he's coming against the temple in Jerusalem. It means he's coming against that kingdom that belongs to Yahweh. He's coming against Israel, and like an eagle that swoops down on its prey, the invading army is going to swoop down on them. And the reason that that is going to happen is because they have transgressed my covenant. In a moment, he's going to say, I could have written thousands of laws for them. But because of their hard-heartedness, they aren't going to listen. They aren't going to pay attention. He did give them a law at Mount Sinai, and they did make a covenant at Mount Sinai. When Moses read out the Ten Commandments and told them that this is what God expected of them, they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do. So they agreed to this covenant with God, and yet they transgressed that covenant and rebelled against my law. Notice, by the way, just parenthetically and theologically, that Hosea understands the law of God to be a covenant. That is why the Ten Commandments are referred to as the words of the covenant, and why they are written on something called the tables of the covenant, and why they were put into a golden box called the Ark of the Covenant, because he was forming a particular covenant with Israel, and that was the purpose of the law. But they rebelled against my law. They cry out to me, my God, we of Israel know you. Now, this is a repeat of something you heard back in chapter 6 a couple weeks ago. They were saying things like, come, let us return to the Lord, for he's torn us and he'll heal us. He has wounded us and he will bandage us. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up after the third day, that we may live before him. So let us know. Let us press on to know the Lord. And I stress to you that that sounded very good. Those were very good words. It sounded like repentant words, but God's reaction to it was, what shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? For your loyalty is like a morning cloud and like the dew that goes away early. In other words, your words are empty. Your words are pointless. In a moment, he's going to compare it to sowing to the wind. It's just stuff that just blows away. And so even though they may say, my God, we of Israel know you, his reaction is, Israel has rejected me. So though they use words hypocritically and claim that they are the people of God, they really, throughout their history, only claim that when they're in real trouble. And then the history is that God delivers them. And then they have some years of peace and safety and plenty, and God gives them food and God protects them. And then they forget about God. And then God has to punish them and bring their enemies back down on them. And then they cry to God again, and then God delivers them again. God sends them a judge. God sends them a king. God delivers them time and time again. So this plea of we of Israel know you is an empty plea because it's not followed up with devotion, which is why he said, you're like the morning clouds. You dissipate so quickly. You disappear like the dew on the grass in the morning. Israel has rejected the good thing. They should have stuck with Yahweh. But what did they do? They went to Assyria. They went to Egypt. They made political deals to try to get protection. What did they do? They made their own gods. They chased after their own gods. God in the law said, don't intermarry with those other nations. Don't give your daughters to marry foreign sons. Don't give your sons to marry foreign women. Not only did they do it, but it started all the way back at Solomon. So despite what they may claim about themselves, God says, Israel has rejected the good, and that's why the enemy will pursue him. Another thing they have done is that they have set up their own leadership in the place of God. They should have followed the law of God, which were all the precepts they needed to operate as a theocracy, as a self-contained society. But instead, they set up their own kings that weren't the kings that God chose. God chose David. God chose Solomon. But then after Jeroboam, there is this whole cycle of kings. A couple weeks ago, I talked to you about several of the kings that were murdered just so that another family could take over the throne. And so they kept setting up this succession of kings that wasn't by God. That's why verse 4 says, they have set up kings, but not by me. And they have appointed princes, but I did not know it. In other words, I was not part of that. That was their scheme. By the way, for those of you who are fans of Seinfeld, there's a left turn you didn't see coming. Verse 4 in the Hebrew isn't, and they have set up kings. It's a single word. It's malach, which means becoming king. And then sarar, which means appointing princes. And then yada, which means I know, which is why yada, yada, yada means, yeah, I know, I know, I know. And so God said, you did all that, and it wasn't by me. I didn't know about it. Now you see the Seinfeld connection? Were you lightly entertained by that? Look at the futility of what they have done. They've appointed their own kings. They've appointed their own princes. They didn't consult with God about it. And with their silver and their gold, which are enrichments that God himself in his sovereignty gave to them, and what did they do with it? They have made idols for themselves. And God knows that these are nothing but empty works of men's hands. They have no power. They have no ability. How frequently, as we've been going through the prophets here, have we seen God mock these gods and say, they can't even stand up on their own. You have to nail them to a chunk of wood. And they can't walk, and they can't think, and they can't talk, and they can't tell you the future, and they can't tell you the past and why it happened. But I can do all that. So he said, with the silver and gold, they have made idols for themselves so that they may be cut off. They did all that, and God is now going to deliver them to this invading army of the Assyrians that is headed their way. Look at verse 5. He has rejected your calf, O Samaria. That's just God saying, I know what you're doing. I know you're worshiping these foreign gods that you made with your own hands out of silver and gold. But I'm the only opinion that matters. And I'm the one who gave you the silver and gold. I'm the one who gives you the food. I'm the one who protects you. I'm the one who takes care of you, which is why I'm going to stop my protection and the Assyrian armies are coming down on you. In a moment, he's going to say all of your best efforts are going to accomplish nothing. And he's going to bring famine onto them, and he's going to withhold the rain from them, and he's going to punish them because they worshiped this calf and then gave credit to the calf with the silver and gold that God gave them. They then spent that on their lovers. And God says, for that reason, I've rejected you. He has rejected your calf, O Samaria, saying, my anger burns against them. That's what he said at Mount Sinai. How long-suffering is our God? Because he wanted to wipe them all out at Sinai had it not been for Moses interceding for the people. All these years later, though he's given them the prophets, though he has sent them judges and delivered them, nevertheless, his anger burns against them for their lack of faithfulness to him. They have all this evidence. They've seen the miracles. They know they've been delivered into this land of milk and honey, this land of plenty. And nevertheless, they continue in their errant, hard-headed ways, which is why he says they're an obstinate people. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable, the NASB says, of innocence? In other words, how long will they remain guilty nonstop? When in fact they have the very law, the very precepts, the covenant of God to show them how to behave like a moral theocratic people. But they continue to reject that so that they can go their own ways, so that they can have kings after their own hearts, so they can set up their own leaders and princes and then make their own gods. That is obstinate. Verse 6, for from Israel is even this. He's still talking about the calf. He's still talking about the golden idols. From Israel is even this. It's almost like God is exasperated in pointing it out. A craftsman made it, so it's not a god. I mean, that's very, very logical. The God who is God, the only God who can say, I am that I am. The only God, the only self-existent God who knows what it is to be a God, who says, I am the one and only God, would know that that's just a chunk of metal. And yet they worship it and give it credit for the things that he himself has done. And he's pointing out the futility, the stupidity of it. From Israel is even this, a craftsman made it. So it is not God, and surely the calf of Samaria will be broken to pieces. God's not going to be broken to pieces. Yahweh remains. But these gods, these other things that they are worshiping, he's going to destroy them. Because they sow the wind and they reap the whirlwind. Very common phrase. Sowing to the wind means that they think they're accomplishing things. I think here he's referring not only to their idol worship and that the idol can't help them, can't save them, can't redeem them, can't protect them, can't provide for them. And yet that's where they're investing their time, their money, their effort, their worship. And they're also making these deals with Egypt and with Assyria, trying to protect themselves. In other words, everything they're doing is utter futility, and the answer is right there in front of them. Yahweh is right there in front of them. They ignore him, the God who actually is, and they chase after these things that are completely meaningless. If that sounds familiar, that is most of our society these days. They sow the wind, but then look, they're going to reap back that wind at cyclonic speed. It is going to come and destroy them. They sow into the wind, it's meaningless. What they're going to reap from that is the wrath of God. The standing grain has no heads. In other words, there's stalks, but there's no fruit. There's nothing to eat. It yields no grain. And even if it did, should it yield a bit, strangers would swallow it up. So I'm going to make them go hungry, but he is also likening them to a plant that is nothing more than a stalk that doesn't bear fruit at all. That's how pointless they've become. Israel is swallowed up. They are now among the Gentiles. Now, this is predicting the coming of the Assyrian captivity. So I think what he's saying is they're acting like the Gentiles. They're being like the Gentiles. They're no different than the Gentiles. The reason that he gave them his law and his precepts was to make them a separate, distinct nation, separate from all the other nations on the earth. And by following after the gods of the foreign nations, by chasing after the politics of these foreign nations, they've just become another one of those nations. They're like a vessel in which no one delights. They've become pointless. They've become useless. For they have gone up to Assyria like a wild donkey all alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. And now he's going to explain what he means when he says Ephraim has hired lovers. And by saying they're like a wild donkey out in the wilderness, he's saying they're just out there in the middle of the plain by themselves. They don't have any help. I'm not going to help them. I'm leaving them to themselves. And so instead they hired lovers. Even though they hire allies among the other nations. He's talking about Assyria and Egypt. Even though they give money to these other nations to try to keep them from invading, here's what God is going to do. Now I will gather them up, and they will begin to diminish because of the burden of the king of princes. That is a reference to the king of Assyria. At that time, he was the most powerful king. He was the king over all the other rulers and princes in the area. And God placed a burden on that king, causing him to go and attack Israel in order to punish Israel. And then you may recall that in Isaiah, we're also told that God will punish Assyria for the haughtiness of heart with which they went and attacked Israel. So God is in control of all of this and has placed this responsibility, this burden on the king of Assyria. The very ones that they're trying to be ally with are also going to be their destruction. I like God's sense of irony. Since Ephraim has multiplied altars for sin, you remember even back at Mount Sinai, once they had built their golden calf, the next thing that Aaron did was he built an altar for it. And they had altars on every high place and altars in the groves. And they had worship of several different foreign gods going on around Egypt. And so they were multiplying these altars to themselves. But then they also had altars to Yahweh. He was just one of the many gods that they were worshiping and that they were sacrificing to. And they multiplied these altars, these sin sacrifice altars. But they have become altars for sinning for him. So even though these were the places where they would sacrifice sin offerings, the very fact that they were offering sin offerings became sin for them. Because they were doing it in the midst of all their hypocrisy and their chasing of their other gods. So even if they were to go to Yahweh and sacrifice to him, he would count that as iniquity for them. Because, again, they refused to treat him as the one and only singular God. Since Ephraim has multiplied altars for sin, they have become altars of sinning for him. And though I wrote for him, for Ephraim, 10,000 precepts of my law, they're regarded as a strange thing. Regarded as a thing we don't know, we don't understand, it's a foreign thing. God gave them 613 precepts. You would think that would be enough. God says, if I gave them thousands more, it wouldn't matter, it wouldn't change anything. They're not listening to the ones I gave them. After all, he gave them 10 to begin with that included, you'll have no other gods before me. They didn't get past number one. And they were already breaking his law. So God mocks them and says, even if I wrote for them 10,000 precepts of my law, they are regarded as a strange thing. As my sacrificial gifts, they sacrifice the flesh and they eat it. In other words, they come to the altars that are dedicated to me, and they sacrifice there. They bring their offerings, and they eat the flesh of it, but the Lord has taken no delight in them. One of the great phrases that the Bible gives us that I love are the many phrases that say that God will forget our sin, that he will forget our iniquity, that he'll cast our sin as far as the east is from the west, that he'll cast it behind his back. Notice when he's talking about them that he says, now he will remember their iniquity. All that stuff they're doing against him, they're going to have to give an account for. He's going to hold them guilty. And they will return to Egypt. In other words, they're going back to bondage. When God introduced himself to Israel collectively in Egypt, he introduced himself as Yahweh and showed himself through giving them Moses, their deliverer, and then showing the plagues until they were finally delivered and then taking them through the Red Sea. He demonstrated who he was in his delivering them from Egypt. And through their 40 years in the wilderness, they complained about water and they complained about food and they complained all the time. And so God says here, I'm just going to send them back to Egypt. Now, where they're going to go is Assyria. And God knows that. He's drawing a connection between Assyria and Egypt in order to say they're going back into slavery, for Israel has forgotten his maker and built himself palaces. And Judah has multiplied fortified cities. So they built palaces in Israel to demonstrate to the surrounding nations that they were rich and powerful. And they built multiplied fortified cities so that they could defend themselves. And so by the works of their own hands, they thought they were going to provide for themselves, they were going to build their own reputation, and they were going to protect themselves. God's response is, but I will send a fire on its cities that it may consume its palatial dwellings. Now, starting at chapter 9, and we're not going to go through chapter 9 tonight. Starting in chapter 9, the first 9 verses are sort of a subheading of the defense that God is giving for himself, his reasoning for his judgment, and the case that he is making against Israel. He's going to kind of sum it up in 4 big sections, 2 of which appear in chapter 9, and then chapter 10 is one, and then chapter 11 is one. I'm not going to go into detail in the first 9 verses here of chapter 9, but I just want you to hear the extremes that God uses in his language to say how severe the punishment is going to be on Israel, and then we'll pick that up next week. Do not rejoice, O Israel, with exultations like the Gentile nations, for you have played the harlot, forsaking your God. You have loved a harlot's earning on every threshing floor. In other words, when you got grain, when you got wine, you credited your foreign gods for it. Threshing floor and wine press will not feed them, and the new wine will fail them. In other words, God saying, I'm bringing a famine on them. I said I wasn't going to comment, and now I'm commenting. It's my want. It's like a habit. I can't do it. They will not remain in the Lord's land, but Ephraim will return to Egypt, and in Assyria they will eat unclean food. They will not pour out drink offerings of wine to Yahweh. Their sacrifices will not please him. Their bread will be like mourner's bread, and all who eat of it will be defiled. For their bread will be for themselves alone, and it will not enter in to the house of Yahweh. What will you do on the day of your appointed feasts, and on the day of the feast of the Lord? For behold, they will go because of destruction. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Memphis, by the way, has a reputation in the history of Egypt as being the place where the dead bodies were laid. And he says, Memphis is going to eat them up. And he mocks them and says, how are you going to keep the feasts that I commanded you in my own law? How are you even going to do that? You're in Assyria. You can't make it to Jerusalem. You can't continue your worship of me. And that's what I'm going to do when I destroy you. I'm going to make it so that you cannot worship me. The days of punishment have come. The days of retribution have come. Let Israel know this. The prophet is a fool. The inspired man is demented because of the grossness of your iniquity and because your hostility is so great. Ephraim was a watchman with my God, a prophet, and yet the snare of a bird catcher is in all his ways, and there is only hostility in the house of his God. They have gone deep in depravity, as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity, and he will punish their sins. Now that sounds like really bad news for Israel, and it's going to get worse. God is just laying out the utter destruction of Israel. And yet we know from the first story of Hosea and his wife Gomer that that's not the end of the story. What we know is that God is also going to go and get them. Despite all of this, do me a favor, turn over to chapter 11 for just a moment and we'll close on this. Go to chapter 11, and we're going to start reading at verse 8. Chapter 11, verse 8, God speaking. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? He's determined to punish them, and yet he's in covenant with them. One of the things that he accuses them of is breaking covenant. But he's not going to diminish his own character. He's not going to change the fact that he made an unconditional covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's not going to change the fact that that land belongs to them in perpetuity. And so he says, how can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I surrender you, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart is turned over within me. All my compassions are kindled. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not destroy Ephraim again. For I am God and not a man. I am the Holy One in your midst. And I will not come in wrath. They will walk in the Lord. He will roar like a lion. Indeed, he will roar and his sons will come trembling from the west. And they will come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria. And I will settle them in their houses, declares the Lord. All I really want you to see, we've got one more quick passage to look at. All I really want you to see is the phenomenal guilt of Israel. Just, they were guilty on every front. As God has been laying out his case against them, they are guilty societally. They are guilty sexually. They are guilty politically. They are guilty in the way that they've chased other gods. There's no facet of their lives that God doesn't point out as being utter guilt. And yet he makes them these promises because I am God and I'm not a man and I am the Holy One in your midst. Aren't you glad to worship a God like that?
Amen.
Because I guess that you all can see a bit of yourself in this description of Israel and that you know that none of us are righteous. That's why we talk so much about human depravity, and that it is a complete depravity, and that salvation is always the result of God saying, I'm not like you. You're men. I'm the holy God, and I will keep my promises to you. That's mind-blowing. but it's an astounding grace, grace, grace. Turn to chapter 14. We'll just read the first three verses. Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take the words with you and return to Yahweh and say to him, take away all our iniquity and receive us graciously, that we may present the fruit of our lips, not so that we can bring the sacrifices that you've already rejected, so that we can come and praise you. The fruit of our lips, Assyria will not save us. We will not ride on horses. In other words, our own strength's not going to save us. Nor will we say again, our God, apparently to our idols and to the calves that we built. We will not say our God to the work of our hands, for in you the orphan finds mercy. Beautiful language. God's going to cast them off till they are like orphans. God is going to send them into Assyria, and he's going to punish them for all that they have done wrong. What he's not going to do is lose them. And he says so, and he even used Hosea and Gomer and the three children as a type, as a shadow, to say, this is my big plan. This is my plan for Israel. And that plan for Israel is still at work at this very moment, because that same God is still at work at this very moment, who can look at guilty sinners, guilty sinner, guilty, underline, big red font, capital letters, guilty sinners. And then for his own grace's sake, be merciful to people who have been orphaned. And that's everything we hope for.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.